army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. Today, I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 70 of Chasing Ghost, an Irregular Warfare podcast. This is Bolivar's Revenge, the Venezuelan Tar Pit, and American Ambition. And here we're going to do some forecasting. We're going to do some historical examination. And of course, we will not do any predictions, as it were, but some housekeeping beforehand. Yes, I have broken my fortnightly cadence, and I am a week late. Been rather busy lately with both family things, turbulence, professional stuff, my day job, all of those things. But nonetheless, here we are. So back to our fortnightly cadence between this and my companion podcast, which is War Notes, a Conflict podcast. For those of you who have been listening for a while, the common thread throughout most of these podcasts happens to be that American ambition when it comes to martial enterprises planet-wide, especially after the end of World War II in 1945, has met with stalemate, defeat, and failure in such a consistent fashion that one can call it a sterling record of those things that I just mentioned. When it comes to these kind of imperial ambitions, we have rarely seen since that time, after especially the 1960s and 70s, because there was unpleasantness in the Dominican Republic and such, where after World War II, there was a lesser operational tempo in actually putting boots on the ground in Latin America. When it did happen, it would happen in Central America. A brief example would be in Nicaragua, when the Sandinistas took possession of the government, and across the Gulf of Fonseca between El Salvador and Nicaragua, they were smuggling arms to the FLN, which was the Marxist insurgency organization that was fighting in El Salvador proper. And mind you, this could be one of those few times where we could score a modest win in the sterling track record of stalemate and defeat for American arms, where a congressional limitation on the number of military advisors was imposed, and it would be a number that was less than 100, most likely less than 50. The details are spotty, and I suspect that as a result of that, those who were sent down managed to, in a military advisory capacity, help to build a Salvadoran army organization that, in the end, defeated the communist insurgency in El Salvador proper. We can fast forward now decades to the modern day, and we see that despite some people having some ambivalence or even moral injury from what Bukele is doing down there in El Salvador, he has done some amazing things as far as reducing crime, incarcerating actual violent criminals, and putting that country on a path to economic redemption that it hasn't seen in decades. Because this is an American podcast originating out of the U.S. and employing the English language, and I do not speak Spanish. My wife speaks a little bit of it. One finds that consistently, when you listen to a podcast like mine or others, we all have our institutional and parochial biases as far as from whence we speak, in this case, the United States, the language we employ, in this case, English, and it starts to inform the way we observe pattern relationships, the way wars are fought, and we make cultural assumptions about those very things. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to
take us up to a little bit higher level, and what we're going to do is examine very quickly what has happened in Latin America for the last few hundred years, because remember, I am very fond of saying you can't possibly know where you are unless you know where you've been, and we are not going to conduct the or employ the cardinal historiographical sin that is done by so many people, which is presentism, and taking our present moral compass and apprehension of how the world works, and then in the rearview mirror, when we're examining history, we take our present mindset, especially when it comes to moral comeuppance, and we establish that, well, they were so much worse or better than us because they don't emulate the rather enlightened and Renaissance thinking of the modern age since the end of World War II. Therefore, they are lesser people. They are not lesser people. And we've discussed before, if this is the first time you've heard me say it because you're new to my podcast, welcome aboard. I will give you the apex example, and that would be slavery. Before 1800, slavery was the way of the world for thousands of years. It was accepted among all peoples planet-wide that the ownership of other human beings, however those human beings had been acquired, was just the way things were. All of a sudden, we have the brilliant Christian William Wilberforce at the turn of the 19th century, and he'd been doing this for a while, even beforehand, at the end of the 18th century, standing astride the English Parliament and looking at both sides of the aisle and declaring that the ownership of other human beings is wrong. He's laughed at for years. Then, towards the middle of the 19th century, it is the English who are the ones who are standing astride the world and spending blood and treasure, especially when it comes to fighting sale and the interception of slave trades and such, that declares that slavery is done and the English government will not tolerate it in England nor in its empire, on which the sun, of course, never set. So the reason that I say that is that we always have to check our biases, and all humans are biased. There's no such thing as objective truth when it comes to history. There's no such thing, for the most part, outside of scientific empiricism and limited methodologies, objective truth, period. I have urged my listeners, for instance, never to watch the news and only to use opinion pieces and editorials if they're trying to see what's happening in world events, or they can examine very footnoted and evidence-based material as long as you follow those secondary sources and those primary sources that are in there to discover what the single most accurate picture is of what's happening at that time. So for me, I'm going to step outside for a slight preview in this particular episode of my American biases, if I can, and my Eurocentric biases, if I can. And we will examine the history in South America of conflict, because there's a hell of a lot of it. And that conflict also occurred before the 15th century, among all the numerous tribes that were there, before the European invasion, as it were, which happened towards the end of the 15th century, where you had colonial powers, particularly from Europe, who made landfall in South America and started establishing colonial holdings, everything from just south of what is now the American border with Mexico, and we all know the stories of the conquistadors and the extraordinarily lopsided victories that those Spanish warriors had against the Aztecs and the Mayans and such, who were located in that area. But there were also conflicts exclusive of Europeans necessarily that occurred as a result of European proxy governments down there, along with their indigenous populations, getting into fights with each other on a consistent basis. Now, the Monroe Doctrine, a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy, and that was James Monroe in 1823, declared that the Western Hemisphere was off limits to further European colonization or interference, and pledged that the U.S. would not meddle in European affairs. if only America had kept that promise. And by the way, there was a very difficult problem here, and that's the fact that you can have all the ambition you wish to say that you don't want the Europeans to continue or expand interfering in South America. Well, they did not have the cash in the bank to cash those checks. Hence, it was far more speechifying than actually being able to do so. Now, in 1904, there's the Roosevelt corollary to this Monroe Doctrine. That's when Teddy Roosevelt asserted the U.S.'s right to intervene in the affairs of Latin American countries that were unable to manage their own stability or fulfill their international obligations. And this transformed that doctrine from a statement of non-interference into a justification for U.S. intervention, leading to many what would be called, not fondly, the Banana Wars, starting in that early age of the 20th century, all the way up into World War II. And even after, there would be a lesser frequency, but they would occur nonetheless. The number of wars in Latin America, which begins at the Mexican border with the United States and goes all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, which is just across the way from Antarctica, and everything in between, is chock full of conflict. Is it all recorded conflict? It is not, because prior to the 15th century, for those that were indigenous, as with all countries on planet Earth and Earth's history, they were all fighting among each other. But did wars occur in these respective countries? Of course they did. When you look at everything from the Peruvian War of Independence to the Argentine War of Independence, Chilean War of Independence, Venezuelan War of Independence, Brazilian Independence War, and the Cisplane and the Gran Colombia Peru War, these interstate wars that would occur on contiguous borders, there were civil wars such as the Chilean Civil War of 1829. All of those ones that I just listed occurred between 1805 and 1835. And then you can also look at other wars that started occurring, believe it or not, in the 20th century, regardless of U.S. intervention in that. There was the Thousand Days War in Colombia, the Paraguayan Civil War, the War of the Generals in Ecuador, the Ecuadorian Civil War. I'm giving you highlights here of all of these wars that occurred both before and after World War II in the 20th century. But when you look at the wars that occurred in the 19th century, a tremendous number of them occurred. So I leave you with this as a preamble to our discussion today about Venezuela, to let you know that South America is no stranger to intrastate civil wars and interstate, both contiguous and non-contiguous wars, in the regional conflict complexes that comprise all of those countries down there. And that they are no stranger to non-European sponsored wars within South America proper, in which maybe the Europeans, or in some cases the Asians, would provide succor material support and training and such. But nonetheless, these were wars fought by what one could classify loosely as indigenous populations fighting other indigenous populations. And of course, we know before the Europeans even arrived in the 15th century, that the kind of indigenous clashes, if it's anything to be compared to what happened on the North American continent before that time, before Europeans even arrived, would be savage and ferocious. So that being the case, let us take a look at Venezuela, which is the subject of our discussion today. 1567 is the first recorded battle, and that would be the Battle of Maricopana. Please excuse my improper use of the Spanish argot if that occurs. My apologies to those of you who are exquisite Spanish speakers. Military engagement between the Spanish conquistadors and their allied indigenous people in the coalition of Caribbean tribes, who were led by Guaycaipuro and commanded by Chief Tiuna. The battle finished with the defeat of those Caribbean tribes by those European soldiers. This would be followed under 300 years later in 1811 to 1823 by the Venezuelan War of Independence. 1859 to 63 would be the Federal War. There would be a Dutch-Venezuela War, believe it or not, in 1908. And that was a dispute that broke out between the Netherlands and Venezuela after the Venezuelan president, Cipriano Castro, cut off trade with the Dutch Caribbean island of Curaçao. Venezuela expelled the Dutch ambassador, prompting a Dutch dispatch of three warships. They had orders to intercept every ship that was sailing under the Venezuelan flag. So this was a very brief venture, about a month. I think it was November and December, 1908. And then it was resolved by just a lack of interest in both parties in pursuing it. And it is hidden in the dustbin of history as we speak. Do take a look at a map of Venezuela. You will notice it is at the top of the South American continent, just touching the Caribbean, due south of Central America. It has flatlands. It has a very substantial coastline. It has a very substantial maritime tradition, and it has mountainous regions also. Military coups in Venezuela are quite popular. The first one I discovered occurred apparently in 1958, and most of these are strongman coups displacing other strongmen who happened to be there at the time. And I want to bring to your attention something very interesting when you examine the history of Venezuela. Venezuela hasn't always been the communist, socialist basket case that it has been under Hugo Chavez and Maduro. And let's keep in mind when I relate this story to you that Hugo Chavez, the communist, socialist, however you want to characterize him, let's call him a government supremacist, who thought that free markets should be disposed of and everything controlled by the government. And of course, Maduro inherited this conceit and continues that to this day. Chavez assumed power in 1998. He had tried a coup in 1992, failed, was jailed, and he was pardoned after 2 years, consolidated his efforts in the Fifth Republic Movement political party. And then until his death in 2013, he ruled with an iron fist and managed through his socialist slash communist slash government supremacist policies to take what was arguably one of the richest oil-rich countries in the world and turn it into a very ineffective third world country for the most part. So what I want to do here is illustrate this brief, enigmatic episode that occurred in 1967 and how when one looks at that, and then you fast forward to the time that I just talked about, you start to scratch your head and say, that's quite the turnaround. So let's look at that very quickly. I want to discuss a brief event that occurred on 8 May 1967 in the Maturacuto raid. In that raid, four Cuban and eight Venezuelan guerrillas sailed into Venezuelan territorial waters in a warship disguised as a fishing boat, disembarking on two rafts, once close enough to the coast. They brought with them AK-47s and $10,000 in both U.S. dollars and Venezuelan bolivars. Remember, Simon Bolivar was the founder, the enigmatic and charismatic founder of Venezuela in the early 19th century, which they planned to hand over to the revolutionary left movement forces stationed in the Andes in a mountainous region, who were attempting to overthrow this Venezuelan government at the time. Now, the revolutionary left movement, it had split from Acción Democracia in 1916, became involved in armed guerrilla struggle against the Venezuelan state. They merged with the Movement for Socialism in 1988. The origins of that party can be traced directly to the first visit Commander Fidel Castro made to Venezuela, specifically to the capital of Caracas, in January 1959 to celebrate the first anniversary of the fall of the military dictatorship of General Marcos Perez Jimenez. A little under 3 years after that, on May 9th, 1962, the Communist Party of Venezuela and the MIR are disabled by the government of Romulo Betancourt, and they assume the armed struggle that lasts until the first government of Rafael Caldera, who was deposed when Hugo Chavez took over in 98, if I recall. I think Caldera was in office from 94 to 98. However, it was MIR that first launched to the armed struggle in Venezuela, causing serious urban clashes between 61 and 62, and the installation of a guerrilla front in the east of the country, which they called Front Manuel Ponte Rodriguez, to be later dismantled in 64 by the Venezuelan army and reconstituted in 65 with the name of Guerrilla Front Antonio José de Sucre. Now, you don't have to keep up with all of this because I provide these details to give you like a snapshot of what was happening with liberation theology sponsored by parts of the Catholic Church, the Marxist movements that were so popular from north to south in Latin America during that time in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and that would later find their most successful incantation of communist rule in Hugo Chavez, in this very rich and well-endowed country, especially with its oil reserves, which are world-class. So we return to that day, 8 May 1967, with the invasion of Machurucuto. And once they landed, those Venezuelans set off to the east while the Cubans headed back to the warship. However, their raft capsized on the way back, leading to one of them, later identified as Lieutenant Pico, drowning and forcing the other three to swim to shore. Local fishermen found one of the guerrillas' rafts and notified the armed forces. On the evening of 10 May, 48 hours after they had landed, troops found the three Cubans, commencing a battle which ended the following day. Two were captured. Venezuelan authorities stated the contingent's leader, Antonio Briones Mantaro, was killed while trying to escape, but the Cuban government has disputed this, claiming he was covertly executed after the fact. The eight Venezuelans managed to evade capture for 100 days and eventually reach friendly territory. The aftermath of this, the two captured Cubans, Manuel Gil Castellanos and Pedro Cabrera Torres, wrote signed confessions detailing the raid. President Raul Leone at the time held a conference soon after where they were shown off to the press. Both of them committed suicide in prison. Venezuela decided to abstain from invoking the Rio Pact, which is a hemispheric defense treaty to which most Latin American nations were signatories at the time, where a strike on one of the countries would lead all the other countries to join forces to defend them. Instead, they decided to request a meeting with the Organization of American States on 15 May, and then the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Cuba responded on 18 May, stating in a lengthy document that they didn't aid the guerrillas and that what is decided in Washington by the OAS and its master does not matter. The revolutionary left movement ceased its insurgency in 1969 and became a political party. Dissidents within the group formed splinter movements, which continued guerrilla activities, but their subversive activities shrunk to a minimum during the 1970s. I would tell you that it did sink to a low hum, but it never evaporated and it never went away, and it culminated in the election. This was part of that. I'm not saying that these people are entirely responsible. Culminated in Hugo Chavez coming into office in 1998 and imposing his communist and Marxist imprimatur upon the Venezuelan character of governance at the time. Now, one reason why a lot of my audience tunes in is so that we can sort of dust those neglected corridors of history that seem to have correlative and causative linkages to what's happening today to give us a better and deeper, more explanatory framework of why things are happening the way they are today. So I did want to dig just a little deeper into Cuba-Venezuelan relations, because what you'll discover is that after Hugo Chavez and Maduro assumed office, and now it's been nearly 27 years, the relationship between what is arguably the most influential and capable in many arcane fashions Marxist country in this entire sphere below the Mexican border, which will be Cuba, is I think it's going to connect itself in the future if America decides to make landfall on Venezuela and conduct military action. So between Cuba and Venezuela, relations were established in 1902. This relationship deteriorated in the 1960s. I just described one thing that happened, with which one can call a very thumbnail exposure of a very tiny pinprick of attempted Marxist mischief in Venezuela in 1967. As I described, part of that, when they broke relations in late 1961, that destabilizing factor was the Cuban support for anti-government guerrilla forces that operated in remote rural areas. Relations were reestablished in 1974. Now we fast forward to 1999, and the bilateral relations significantly improved during Chavez's term. Chavez, as a matter of fact, formed a major alliance with Cuban President Fidel Castro and significant trade relationships with Cuba since his election in 1999. The warm relationship between the two countries continued to intensify after decades of close ties in the Caribbean. Several governments in the region started to distance themselves from the United States. Hugo Chavez described Castro as his mentor and called Cuba, quote, a revolutionary democracy, end of quote. The reason why this is so important, and remember, I do forecasts here, not predictions, because predictions have a higher evidentiary bar that are necessary for them, and my forecasts allow me to fudge a bit and be a little more fuzzy about correlative and causative foundational root causes and the emerging causes that come from those in what things are starting to look like, is that if America does militarily involve itself in an overt fashion and not a clandestine or covert fashion with Venezuela, for whatever reasons of causes belli the current administration comes up with, when you go to war with Venezuela, you are also going to war with Cuba for reasons that I'm going to elucidate. In October 2000, Chavez and Castro signed the Convenio Integral de Cooperación, under which Venezuela will send 53,000 barrels per day of oil to Cuba and will receive technical support in the fields of education, healthcare, sports science, and technology, and by the way, military. In February 2005, Venezuela increased its discounted oil shipments to Cuba to 90,000 barrels a day. But for Cuba, 90,000 barrels a day is of high value because it's a relatively impoverished nation with few natural resources extractive and translating to energy like oil. As a matter of fact, in 2007, the two countries established a joint venture to revamp the Cienfuegos oil refinery in Cuba. Venezuela and Cuba were set to invest approximately $800 million to $1 billion in primary stage into the program. According to the scheme, 51% share of the plant will be held by Cuba, 49% to the Venezuelans, which has a state-owned petroleum company that it used as a subsidiary. In December 2007, Chavez attended the Petrocaribe Summit in Havana, along with several prime ministers and presidents from around the Caribbean. Now, fast forward to 2019, and the opposition-controlled National Assembly voted and approved to cut Venezuela's oil supply to Cuba, saving at least $3 million daily, according to its speaker, Juan Guaido. This did not and does not sit well with the Cubans. There are also close military ties with helping Caracas in its goal to transform its military. This transformation process began in 2004, and as a result of an effort to remove U.S. influence from the country, the Army of Venezuela is trying to replace NATO-compliant Belgian rifles, which would be FNFALs, with the AK-103, which I commend as a terrific Kalashnikov rifle. The military of Cuba has over 40 years' experience handling Soviet and Russian military equipment. So I would suggest that Cuba punches well above its weight class militarily when it comes to both unconventional and conventional warfare. The Cuba that we know today, which was formed as a communist Cuba starting in 1959, we see its first external support to a war very far from its shores in the Caribbean in Algeria when they sent forces to assist in the overthrow of the government there at the time. Even during the Congo crisis from 63 to 65, it was supported by the Soviet Union, China, and Cuba. The Cubans did eventually withdraw from the Congo. They were also involved in the Guinea-Bissau War of Independence from 63 to 74, the Bolivian campaign from 66 to 67. That's when Che Guevara was captured and executed. The Yemenite War of 1972. In the Yom Kippur War, Cuban support was offered to the Arabs. In the Operation Independence in Argentina, they were defeated. Angolan Civil War from 75 to 91 was probably the high point of both Cuban conventional and unconventional operations, where by the mid-1980s, which can arguably be said to be the last gasp of hot wars during the Cold Wars, they acquitted themselves rather well against fabled and, I would say, very competent militaries like the South African Defense Force at the time. When you look at the Somali conflict from 77 to 78, same thing. There was a victory there for the Cubans because there was a Somali withdrawal from the Ethio-Somali War. Cuba, South Yemen, the Soviet Union, and Ethiopia were the ones who managed to put that in the win column. The Ethiopian Civil War, Ethiopia was supported by Cuba at the time from 77 to 91. That became a defeat. The Eritrean War of Independence, 77 to 91, Ethiopia share a contiguous border. That was also a defeat for Eritrean independence. And then, of course, we all know probably, whether through the movies or reading about it or having lived and seen it on the news, in 1983 with the invasion of Grenada, with the modest forces that the Cubans had on board that island. And then after that, everything went to a low hum as far as Cuban involvement in external conflicts sort of ceased to be a factor in 1991. So in 1998, Hugo Chavez takes over, and here you have a Goliath of sorts by Latin American standards when it comes to material and resource wealth, offering a hand over the Caribbean to his Cuban confreres and offering Cuba yet another lifeline. Because what else happens in 1991? Well, it just so happens that between 1989 and 1991, the Soviet Union falls. All of a sudden, we see a correlative, I would suggest to you, causative reason for the Cubans no longer exporting their modest, but at times brilliant, military capabilities overseas. And then Hugo Chavez assumes office in 1998. And all of a sudden, he offers the Castro communist and Cuban communist regime a lifeline of sorts and access to petroleum, wealth, and those kind of things in exchange for things that the Cubans happen to think that they can offer Venezuela. There is a cooperation between the two countries that sort of energizes Cuba from the malaise it would experience after 1991 when it is no longer supported and subsidized by the communists in the USSR. And let's do a thumbnail sketch of the intelligence directorate of the Cubans. And I think that they renamed it the Dirección General de Inteligencia, DGI. That's what we'll call it from this point forward, is the main state intelligence agency of the government of Cuba. Now, not only does it serve as an interior ministry function, as in all communist countries, of that kind of pantopic surveillance and the establishment of informant networks and making sure that they have a finger on the pulse of that country atomistically so that they can hold it under the iron lash of all communist countries with the necessity they have for these very intrusive intelligence organizations, intrusive in this sense, not only within Cuba proper, but also in what it has done overseas. The DGI, the Cuban DGI, is probably one of the most, arguably, the most effective intelligence services in the Caribbean, if not all of Latin America. And not only have they maintained that iron hand over the internal politics of Cuba itself, but have externalized beyond Cuba itself to use that intelligence agency to make mischief on the entirety of the Caribbean and Latin America, and by extension, as I had alluded to earlier, other countries around the world. In Chile, shortly after the election of Salvador Allende, the Marxian government supremacist socialist president of Chile in November 1970, the DGI worked extremely closely to strengthen Allende's increasingly precarious position. As a matter of fact, at the time, the Cuban intelligence station chief Luis Fernandez Ona married Allende's daughter, Beatrice, who later committed suicide in Cuba. Grenada, 1983, I just mentioned that. Shortly after that bloodless coup by Maurice Bishop, the Cuban intelligence organization sent advisors to the island nation to assist the new government. They were also instrumental in persuading the USSR to aid Grenada, aid the Grenadian general Hudson Austin. Now, we're all familiar with Nicaragua, and we know that in the 1980s, you have the Contra scandals in the Reagan administration and the insistence by the Reagan administration that they would put paid and put a stop to the communist revolutions that were occurring throughout Latin America, and that Reagan wanted to put a stamp on Nicaragua to say, this is where we make it stop. Well, that began in 1967 when the Cuban intelligence agencies began to establish ties with various Nicaraguan revolutionary organizations. The Soviets were upset at what they saw as Cuba upstaging the KGB in Nicaragua. By 1970, the intelligence organizations had managed to train hundreds of Sandinista guerrilla leaders and had vast influence over the organization. In 69, as a matter of fact, that Cuban intelligence organization financed and organized an operation to free the jailed Sandinista leader Carlos Fonseca from his prison in Costa Rica. Fonseca was captured shortly after the jailbreak, but after a plane carrying executives from the United Fruit Company was hijacked by the Sandinista Liberation Front, he was freed and allowed to travel to Cuba. By the way, it was this same intelligence organization out of Cuba that collaborated with the FSLN in the botched assassination attempt of Turner B. Shelton, who was the U.S. ambassador in Managua and a close friend of the Somoza family, which would be deposed by the Sandinistas. The FSLN managed to secure several hostages, exchanging them for safe passage to Cuba and $1 million in ransom. After the successful ousting of Somoza, the intelligence involvement in the new Sandinista government expanded rapidly. An early indication of the central role that they would play was a meeting in Havana on 27 July 1979, at which diplomatic ties between the two countries were reestablished after over 25 years. And as a matter of fact, a Cuban intelligence agent at the time, instead of DGI, it was a DI agent, was named ambassador to Nicaragua. Now, Cuban military and intelligence advisors initially brought in during the Sandinista insurgency would swell to over 2,500 and operated at all levels of the new Nicaraguan government. Sandinista defector Alvaro Baldazón confirmed that Cuban influence in Nicaragua's interior ministry was more extensive than was widely believed at the time, and Cuban advice and observations were treated as though they were orders. That is alleged and may not be true. The Cuban intelligence organizations also operated on American territory in Puerto Rico. Dr. Daniel James testified before a U.S. Senate committee that the DGI, working through Filiberto Oviedo Ríos, organized and trained the Liberation Front for Puerto Rico. In that case, it was called the FALN in 1974. In October 1974, Oviedo was arrested and charged with terrorist acts against American hotels in Puerto Rico. And you can go through the history and find out all about this if you wish. By the way, it was in January 1975 that later that year, Fidel Castro sponsored the first World Solidarity Conference for the Independence of Puerto Rico in Havana. Does it have any linkages to the whispers and emerging trial balloons that we've seen lately of Puerto Rican independence in this year, 2025? I'm not certain. This is 50 years after those incidents occurred. It would be interesting to see if there is a relationship between the Cubans and those who are calling for Puerto Rican independence. I am a Florida native. I was born in Miami. And on TV, there is a film called The Wasp Network. It's a 2019 spy thriller about Cuban intelligence operations on American territory in Florida in the 1990s. Being Hollywood, it's very sympathetic to the Cubans, of course, and it is apocryphal and very loose with the actual history. There is the Cuban Five, also known as the Miami Five, five Cuban intelligence officers: Gerardo Hernandez, Antonio Guerrero, Ramon Labanino, Fernando Gonzalez, and Rene Gonzalez, who were arrested in September 1998 and later convicted in Miami, Florida, of conspiracy to commit espionage, conspiracy to commit murder, acting as an agent of a foreign government, and other illegal activities in the United States. The five were in the U.S. to observe and infiltrate the Cuban-American groups Alpha 66, the F-4 Commandos, the Cuban-American National Foundation, and Brothers to the Rescue. They were part of La Red Avispa, the WASP network, which was comprised of at least 27 Cuban spies. The Cuban government acknowledged that the five were intelligence agents in 2001 after denying it for 3 years. It said they were spying on Miami's Cuban exile community, not the U.S. government. Cuba says the men were sent to South Florida in the wake of several terrorist bombings in Havana organized by anti-communist terrorist Luis Posada Carriles, a former CIA operative. This is 1998, and none of this is new. In the 1960s and 70s, there were several attacks against Cuban civilians by U.S.-based exile groups such as Coordination of United Revolutionary Organizations, Alpha 66, and Omega 7. You can dig around and find all that stuff that you want as you wish. In the year 2001, a report by Cuba's permanent mission to the United Nations, the Cuban government cataloged 3,478 deaths as a result of terrorism, aggression, acts of piracy, and other actions. The events cited span the course of 4 decades and pertain to attacks such as the bombing of Cubana Flight 455 by men trained by the CIA, the CIA-supported Bay of Pigs invasion, and the Escambray Rebellion between the government and anti-communist rebels between 1959 and 1965. Now, my suspicion is that WASP network was one of a number of Cuban activities in the United States, espionage activities, especially since the Cuban DGI and the then KGB and probably the successor intelligence organizations in Russia have and continue to have very close relationships and professional and material exchanges in how they conduct their various businesses. As with all espionage and spy activities, you never know when you're going to discover them or how many are actually there. As I have discussed in a larger framework, I suspect that there are thousands of sleeper cell members of militant organizations whether Islamic or otherwise, that are presently here in the United States. And there's a phenomenon, and I've talked about this in earlier episodes, called NOCs, which is non-official cover, which are those espionage agents who come into a country and live as indigenous folks but still carry the water for the country in which they were sent there to do their espionage activities in the first place. My suspicion is the Cubans, being extraordinarily sophisticated in these kind of things, probably have more networks in Florida, if not more networks elsewhere, both here in the United States and in Europe. And now we move on to drug cartels, human trafficking cartels, and all of those that pepper Latin America and extend their tentacles and influence to a planetary degree all over the place. So I've been told that the Cartel de las Solas, which is Cartel of the Suns, again, please, if I'm butchering Spanish, I offer my apologies, is a myth. No one can confirm whether that cartel, which may be one of the largest cartels in the world as far as wealth and influence, actually exists. But then again, on July 25th, 2025, there was a press release from the Department of the Treasury. That press release reads, quote, "Today, the Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control sanctioned the Cartel of the Suns as a specially designated global terrorist. The Cartel of the Suns is a Venezuela-based criminal group headed by Nicolas Maduro Moros and other high-ranking Venezuelan individuals in the Maduro regime that provides material support to foreign terrorist organizations threatening the peace and security of the United States, namely Tren de Aragua and the Sinaloa Cartel." Scott Bessent, the Secretary of the Treasury, goes on to say, "Today's action further exposes the illegitimate Maduro regime's facilitation of narco-terrorism through terrorist groups like Cartel of the Suns. The Treasury Department will continue to execute on President Trump's pledge to put America first by cracking down on violent organizations, including Tren de Aragua, the Sinaloa Cartel, and their facilitators." And it goes on in here to talk about exactly what that is. So here we have, I would suggest, official government confirmation, in this case, the United States government, that Cartel of the Suns actually exists. Now, I mentioned human trafficking and drugs, but there's another thing that they are alleged to have done. And again, this is apocryphal, and I do not have sufficient evidence to say this is anything but speculation. But there's a book coming out called Stolen Elections, The Plot to Destroy Democracy by Ralph Pezzullo. So the book hasn't been released. I saw a great, I'll put it in the show notes, a great Adam Carolla interview with Ralph Pezzullo and Gary Bernstein, in which they discuss Venezuela's participation in color revolutions, which I covered in a previous episode. Color revolutions are the means by which, through hybrid and gray zone warfare, intelligence organizations and their extended government organizations influence election processes overseas. Of course, we all know that that came home in 2020. In this case, the color revolution is designed to manipulate the election process, especially electronically, by altering outcomes of inputs. That's, I think, the easiest way to describe what happens. And Pezzullo's allegation, and he's a former CIA officer, so how much can we believe, how much we cannot? I will let the cards fall where they may. But in this case, his allegation is that so many of the electronic voting vendors, whether it be Dominion or a number of others that are out there in both the U.S. and Europe, happen to be compromised because of their connection to the manipulation operations out of Venezuela. So again, I'm telling you, this is apocryphal, and this book doesn't come out until October. So let's do this. We are going to suspend our disbelief, and we're going to come back to the Venezuelan question. And we're going to ask ourselves, in the past fortnight, why has there been an intimidation campaign by the United States against Venezuela and, by extension, the Venezuelan armed forces? What is it that the Venezuelans are doing, besides having a communist government, that so offends the powers that be in North America? I'm not quite certain. It is premature. I'm trying to put the parts and pieces together. But here's what I would offer you. If America goes to war with Venezuela and offers you the casus belli, that curious Latin phraseology of reasons to go to war, 21 of which were offered for us to go to war in Iraq in 2003, of which all turned out to be false, I'm going to tell you whatever reasons you hear coming out of the official political channels or out of the news cycle from those who oppose or those who support the current administration of Washington, D.C., they will not tell you everything that's going on and all the reasons why. To me, it strikes me that there's going to be some internal friction that will not be visible to normal Americans within the intelligence community and the action communities in the United States government, maybe members of its coalition and allies, who are going to be in the hazard in their assignations. Because I have told you before that when it comes to my Storming America series, which I talked about Islamic sleeper cells rising up one day and reaping exponentially bad and galactic havoc on the United States proper, and how bad that would be, that one of the support mechanisms for their capability to be here is because those cartels own a percentage or number above zero of representatives, of senators from the local to the federal level, and portions of law enforcement. Is it 1%? Is it 10%? Is it 50%? I don't know what it is. But I'm here to tell you that number is above zero. Why would that concern the United States when it comes to color revolutions? Because color revolutions are a primary means for three-letter agencies and the intelligence community in both the U.S. and elsewhere to manipulate elections in a way that elects people who are neutral or beneficial to the national security of the state that is through clandestine and covert means using color revolutions in hybrid and gray zone warfare to bend those countries' political apparatuses to the needs of the external country that is manipulating their elections. So here's what I am suggesting. If America goes to war with Venezuela, it's going to be for a variety of reasons that they admit and a variety of reasons that they won't even talk about. The first one would be we're trying to topple an evil communist dictatorship. Okay. The other one would be we're trying to topple an organization that is supporting terrorism, drugs, human trafficking. Yes, that could very possibly be the case. They will not say that they are doing this because they are the owners of a software code, possibly, according to Ralph Pizzullo, that happens to be the dominant software code in so many electronic vote counting machines around the planet. I normally dip my toe in the conspiratorial fever swamp and don't do lap swims in it. And I'm telling you with a cautionary note that everything I've just described concerning software codes and cartels having any influence operations in which they are the primary political actors in electronic voting mechanisms is something for which the evidence would have to be revealed in the future, for which there is only anecdotal evidence now. Future historians will be able to dig that up through primary and secondary source documentation, asking the right questions and posing the historiographical interrogations of the data and the outcomes and the causes and the effects to determine if that's the case. So I've instantiated these preambles for why America may develop both external and internalized dialogues for why America, possibly a coalition, may seek to go kinetic and go to war with Venezuela for whatever reason that may be. Now let's step away from that very quickly and ask ourselves, what is that going to look like? In 1990-91, the Iraqi army was, on paper, its order of battle was the fifth largest army on planet Earth. It folded and was destroyed in a matter of hours, quite literally 96 hours, in that short four-day war, which some would argue was, since the end of World War II, a military success in the ledger for the United States military. But if that were the case, of course, why would America have to return to Iraq in 2003? So fast forward now today, 2025, looking at Venezuela, looking at the saber rattling that's going on both sides and the threats that are being made in an overt and covert fashion against the Venezuelan military. What kind of military do they have? It is not considerable at all. The Bolivarian National Armed Forces of Venezuela, personnel conscription, 18 to 30 years of age, 30-month term. Active forces in 2020 are 109,000. Paramilitary, according to a 2018 census, 220,000. They spend less than $1 billion a year on their armed forces. Their army has roughly 63,000 troops. They have 6 operating divisions. They have an Army Aviation Command, a Corps of Engineers, an Army Logistics Command, Education Command. The Venezuelan Navy is tiny, 30,000 personnel, 12,000 Marines, 600 personnel naval aviation, and their air force is inconsiderable, and it is not large at all, nor is their National Guard, nor is their national militia. On paper, an inconsiderable force. But I offer you these 3 cautionary suggestions that America's military can smack down this cardboard figure posing as an army, navy, and air force in the Venezuelan armed forces. But in this being the conclusion of the first quarter of the 21st century, many revolutions in military affairs that I've talked about in previous episodes may come to a head here. One of those is UAVs, FPVs, drones, and passive acquisition SAMs, which are surface-to-air missiles such as Stingers or Russian variants or Chinese variants of shoulder-launched missiles like that. It will cause a lot of problems. The guerrilla insurgency, and remember, America and the West can't fight insurgencies well at all, will not only be a thorn in the side of any potential American military invasion or occupation, but communications means, covert communications means, the cryptologic means that have been democratized to make them rather cheap to employ at the wholesale level will cause a tremendous amount of problems for the occupying forces that are conducting the counterinsurgency and provide a lot of force multipliers for the insurgents themselves. I also think that the Cubans, and it's one reason why I spent so much time discussing Cuban intelligence and Cuban military capability, the Cubans are going to be the bridge. They're going to provide the means between the BRICS countries, Iran, Russia, China, and all of those allied to that particular realignment of nation states planet-wide in this 21st century. They will provide the bridge to Venezuela to bring in all of the latest technology that we've seen on display in the Ukraine and that we've seen emerging from the countries that I just talked about. This is going to cause significant problems. And now we come to what may be the first and worst possibility, nay, I would say probability, in this conflict, and that is the leveraging of the cartel's capabilities to do untold mayhem and mischief in CONUS proper. Here's what we have to agree on, and I think it's very hard for anybody to provide me with evidence to the contrary, as I have discussed in previous episodes, and that is that the cartels, all of them, have a very sophisticated, deep, and long-time relationship for logistical arterials, logistical infrastructure, warehousing, the covert and clandestine means of communication, the personnel on American soil proper, and all the people that they own, again, in a percentage or number above zero, who are actual cartel employees or have been influenced by the cartels to do their bidding, who are in law enforcement from the local to the federal level and in political office from the local to the federal level. This will be something that the Cubans, I think, uniquely set to do so because of their capabilities and natural inclination to assist the Venezuelans in capitalizing and leveraging these unique gray zone, hybrid zone, and sleeper cell activities in the United States proper, so that if an American military campaign is launched against the Venezuelans, that military campaign will come home in a big and savage way. So that concludes today's episode. I appreciate you listening. I wanted to thank all of my listeners, especially those who are maybe brand new to the podcast. Those who have been listening for a while, I want to thank you for your continued solicitude. You can find this podcast on your favorite vendor for podcasts. I would urge you, if you get the opportunity, if you like the content, please leave a starred review. If you leave a narrative review, I will be forever grateful. And let your friends and colleagues know, if you know people who are as interested in this stuff as apparently you and I are, if we stayed together for this entire hour. So again, thanks so much. I have a Substack, a Chasing Ghost Substack. You can find that address in the show notes. I have an email address at which you can write me with recommendations, gentlemanly critiques, questions, suggestions for future episodes and things like that. cgpodcast@pm.me. That's cgpodcast@pm.me. And again, thanks for listening. This is Bill out.